Storms have a way of providing comfort to some and chaos for others. But on the water, there is no option to relax and breathe a breath of fresh air or get out every anxiety-reducing method you've ever found to work for you. There is simply too much work to be done. Angle the boat just so to avoid the rogue waves, ride up and over them, don't get hit from the side, and try to place yourself so that the waves don't break inside of the boat. Add the complication that your job is to be on the water, providing stability to an even larger ship, and you may not notice when your own boat begins to sink. And as you glide into darkness and despair, as you find every door that leads to safety is locked tight, and as you settle into the reality that you're more than 6 feet under, your options begin to dwindle, and the only thing left on your side is luck. Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. I am your host, Kayla, and the ever-favorite Anne is back.
Hello.
And for those of you who do not follow me on Instagram, you probably will not have seen the poll that I did a few weeks ago, or it was a couple months ago now, I think.
I don't have Instagram, so I don't even follow you on Instagram.
That's
so
okay.
I found you on the podcast app, though.
Yeah.
And Facebook.
Yes.
So yeah, I follow on both.
I'm really bad about like putting it out there to my friends and being like, here, follow me. This is what I'm doing.
I'll just start sharing everything.
Yeah. So on Instagram, you have the option to do polls. And I basically did like I had to do a two pager because I have so many hosts that there weren't enough options for me to put list everyone out. And out of everyone, the overwhelming majority said that they wanted to hear more from you. And
which I find hilarious because I feel like all I do is just go, wow.
I
listened to a couple of the episodes that I did with you and I was like, I'm not adding much here.
Well, maybe that's part of it. I mean, what you do add is quality. So
there we go. We'll go with that.
So for the listeners, Anne and I are kind of, I don't want to say scrambling to get this episode in, but I certainly felt like at one moment that I was scrambling to get another episode drafted and fit in because Anne is having a baby. And
I almost had it today.
Almost, yeah. Well, we're really getting to the finish line. And yeah, so by the time you're listening to this episode, Anne may be holding her sweet little baby in her arms instead Yay. Of her belly. So
I sure hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you're to the point of ready to have it.
Yeah, we're ready. Ready to go.
So you may or may not have noticed a new look to the podcast stuff because I have been rebranding, and once I figure out, you know, there's going to be some new cover art and logo stuff for social media and episode art, and I'm even working on getting an intro song to put in the very start of it.
Nice.
That's a whole realm that I have know nothing about. I had an intro song that I decided was like too suspenseful for what I'm trying to accomplish here. Honestly, I don't actually know what I'm trying to accomplish here. I'm just trying to tell you stories that I enjoy.
I mean, I liked the intro song that I listened to
mm-hmm.
on the podcast that I've followed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, it's another thing that I'm adding to the list to try to have a more concise idea with what I'm trying to put out into the world and have it all kind of like mesh well together.
Makes sense.
And I don't know what I'm doing, just to be clear, but we're figuring it out.
Yeah. Do any of us know what we're doing?
No.
Yeah.
No. The only way you figure it out is to just do it. Yeah. And so that's pretty much what this entire podcast has been about is.
Well, and Sam asked me yesterday, you know, even with the baby thing, he's like, do you feel ready for this? And I was like, in what way?
It's a little late to be asking that question.
I was like, the nursery's done, but everything else, no. Like, we have all the tangible items sitting in our home.
You figure it out.
Yeah, you do.
And I mean, especially when it comes to babies, people can give you all the advice in the world, but you're going to learn what works for you and your partner and your child and your family and the people who are actively involved in its care.
Oh, for sure.
So it's what works for the majority might not work for you.
Yeah, it'll all work out.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
And your podcast will work out too. You'll find the song.
I'll find a song. I already have a look that I really like. And the website, I'm trying to like get everything going at one time. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to get like everything changed for what you're seeing while you're listening. And then you go to my website and it's still just kind of chaotic. So I'm trying to figure out my website. That's really the only thing I have besides the song. The website's the last thing I need to do.
It's like a grand reopening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a relaunch. And, yeah. It'll happen when it happens. And that may be before this episode. It may be after this episode.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Whatever. I've got all the time in the world.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. So we are going to talk about clearly a boat that sunk in the ocean. And I didn't really, you know, write in a good transition between, you know, talking about a baby and boat sinking. So we're just going to jump right into it.
Yay.
A tugboat, the Jackson 4, which was owned by Sea Trucks Group, was one of three tugboats stationed nearly 20 miles or 32 kilometers off of the coast of Nigeria to help steady an oil tanker that was in the Atlantic Ocean. And these tugboats were there because a storm was blowing in and causing this tanker to really jostle around enough that it made people uncomfortable. And as you can imagine, not only because of the environmental impact that an oil spill has, but also the monetary impact mm-hmm. an oil spill would have, pretty much everyone is going to try to avoid this tanker spilling anything.
Oh, for sure.
So the oil tanker was one of Chevron's, which is a part of a $3 billion industry. And I threw in that little note because I heard, like, in my mind, $3 billion for the oil industry sounds small.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Like, I for sure thought it would be more than that. But what do I know about oil? I work in real estate, okay? Now, tugboats are used for a variety of tasks on the water, but their primary use is to host large ships in and out of ports by pushing or pulling them. Another use is to add an anchor point to large ships to help stabilize them in rough waters, just like this one was doing off the coast of Nigeria.
I'll be honest, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. I learned things about tugboats researching this.
Yeah.
They also can be used as icebreakers and salvage boats, which means that they pull things out from under the water. They provide assistance to ships on fire or simply to just guide ships through narrow passageways.
I was going to say, I feel like I knew some of those about tugboats, but I didn't know that they were stabilizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think what essentially happens for the stabilizing is that instead of using the the, I'm going to call it torque. That may be the incorrect word. Mm-hmm. But instead of using the torque to pull a ship or to push it or to maneuver it in any way, they have it like just enough that it's holding everything still.
Yeah, especially if they had three of them on different sides mm-hmm. of the tanker, just kind of keeping it flat or even.
Yeah, just something to help keep it from tossing to one side or the other enough that
it makes sense
something would happen, which, yeah, that's I'm happy for it.
Tugboats are underrated.
They are, for sure. Because large ships have more difficult time maneuvering and their ability to make minor corrections diminishes as they are loaded up and get heavier, tugboats glide in to provide the assistance they need to get from A to B in a safe manner. These large ships, as they work in and out of ports, are often in more shallow water, which basically means that there isn't enough water passing through the rudders to provide the kind of power the ship needs to move forward, backwards, or side to side. Tugboats get their power from both horsepower from the engine and bullard pull, which is essentially the pulling power, which takes into account both the horsepower and how the people directing the boat do so. So the people on board and how they operate has an effect on the bullard power.
Interesting.
For very simple math purposes, a 5,000 horsepower engine, the bullard pull would be anywhere between 50 and 70 tons of pull. Tugboats have huge engines and huge propellers in comparison to the size of the actual boat that they are on, which is part of the reason why they are so strong. Mm-hmm. Tugboats will have an engine with the capacity of 1,800 to 4,600 horsepower. So
they're probably just big enough to support the engine.
I think so. I think that's the purpose of it. So there was a company that I looked at that has tugboats specifically for stabilizing ships on the ocean, and that's where I got the calculation for the 5,000 horsepower. Apparently not many tugboats have that high of horsepower. Like 4,600 is typically like the quote-unquote max, but it's not unheard of to have a higher horsepower engine. But then you start needing to get a larger boat, which kind of, apparently there's a perfect calculation for boat size, engine size, and what its capacity is. And the larger you get, you might think like, oh, well, then it would have the capacity to hold more horsepower and be able to do more. But it as you get larger, it starts to take more horsepower to run the actual boat than to assist with other ships. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It makes me want to actually do research on tugboats, because now I want to know if like some of them can move more than just like forward and back, especially the stabilizing ones. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any like side-to-side capability, or if just by being connected to the ship, you can kind of swing it so that way you're, I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
What their actual radius is, their turn radius kind of.
Yeah. That would be interesting. I'm sure there's a variety of tugboats out there that, you know, mm-hmm. some, like I said, some specialize in breaking ice. So they're probably less concerned about pulling a ship than, you know, making sure that the front of the boat is exactly what it needs to break through ice.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't surprise me if there's...
Fun anecdote. I once did, was a part of an icebreaker question where the person actually asked if you were a ship, what kind of ship would you be?
Okay.
And I actually answered, I'd probably be something like a tugboat.
Okay.
not very flashy, but I can probably get a job done if you need me to. That was my awesome answer.
That's awesome. I don't know what kind of boat I would be. I feel like I would be like a canoe or something, because I'm just like reliable. I'm there. I can float, but I'm also not that great in the water. So like me as a human, I'm not that great in the water. Yeah, that would be interesting. I'm actually doing another episode on boats in, I don't know when yet, maybe the month of April, maybe the month of May. It's on the agenda.
Sure.
And like, I've learned so much about boats between researching this one and researching that one. I'm like, I know about water.
Well, see, even like sailboats, like, you know, they're small. They're a lot of fun. I know that, you know, people that have them, it's an entire hobby, you know, but again, I think it's too flashy for me. I think I'd be a tugboat.
Tugboats are probably safer. I feel like they're probably safer, unless you're on this tugboat.
Yeah.
Like Harrison O'Keen, who was 29 years old and working as the cook for himself and 11 other men who worked as the crew on board of the Jackson 4 tugboat. Growing up in Warri Delta, Nigeria, he was one of the younger of 13 kids. It doesn't say exactly what order it was, but when you have 13 kids, does it really matter?
No, he was in the back half.
Yeah, he was on the younger side. And so his mom always referred to him as the helper, as he was always the first of the kids to volunteer to help his mom carry vegetables to markets so that way she could sell them.
How appropriate he landed on a tugboat. The helper of boats.
How appropriate. That's a good point. His work as a cook often took him in on get the words out. His work as a cook often took him onto tugboats for missions exactly like the one described above, where a storm rolled in, there was an oil tanker that needed some support, and he would be on board the tugboat to provide the crew with the sustenance they need to manage everything appropriately. At about 5 a.m. on Sunday, May 26th of 2013, Harrison woke up to start his usual activities for the day. He first started the burners to get them hot to cook breakfast, and he hadn't even bothered to grab clothes yet and just went straight to the bathroom. He got to the bathroom, sat down on the toilet, when suddenly a large wave hit the side of the tugboat.
It's not the type of compromising position you want to be in.
It's only funny because he lived.
Yeah.
Okay. It's only funny because he lived. The crew felt the boat as it was lifted into the air, and they quickly became disoriented when they were all thrown from their positions and felt like their world was turned upside down. Momentarily confused, Harrison started to open the door of the bathroom when the toilet fell on him into the head.
Oh, so, my gosh. Not the way to start the morning.
No, that's a real rough way to start the morning.
Guy doesn't even have pants on.
Poor guy. He brought his hand to the cut on his head, pulling it away to see blood, and then the lights in the boat went out. The Jackson 4 had indeed been turned upside down, and without the ability to right itself, the boat quickly filled with water and sank the 30 meters or about 100 feet to the ocean floor. The tugboat had been sinking fast enough that Harrison felt the shudder when it collided with the bottom and finally came to rest. Initially, Harrison made his way out of the bathroom where he and three others had struggled with opening a door that led out of the cabin. Unfortunately, and I did not know this about the Nigerian area, but it makes a little bit of sense. Unfortunately for everyone involved, many of the doors that led from inside of the cabin to outside of the boat were kept locked all the time because the area was known to have pirates, and it was a really simple safety measure. Quote unquote, simple safety measure. So they now didn't have the keys to unlock this door and were trying to get it open. This safety measure, though, then became a threat to their lives as they could not open the door to escape. After a few minutes of struggling with his crewmates to open the door, Harrison decided to go try somewhere else and ended up getting swept up by water that was flooding in and pulled into a different room that had a pocket of air about 4 feet large. This second room was another bathroom, but it was attached to a different section of the cabin. And when he was swept in, the water also slammed the door, separating the two parts of the cabin shut, and he could not get it back open again.
Oh, gosh.
This caused him to lose access with the cabin he was originally in, and therefore contact with his crewmates that he had just been with. So he was now alone, and in this, luckily, air pocket, in the dark. I can't imagine how disorienting that would be.
Yeah. I mean, even if you know the ship really well, having it turned upside down, everything has shifted at this point.
Mm-hmm. Toilets are falling on heads.
Yeah. Well, and even being in an air pocket, it's like, how do you start risking what you're going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you and I can sit here in the comfort,
yeah,
you know, of being in a home.
Yeah.
Strategizing for him, but this is all happening within seconds.
Yeah. And, you know, you can probably grasp, oh, the boat has sunk.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, like, accepting that and then figuring out a game plan for that is, it's going to take way more time than just being like, oh, we've sunk. You know, like, and on top of that, what sort of game plan do you make when you're in the ocean and your boat sinks?
Yeah, he's 30 feet below.
He's 100 feet below.
100 feet below.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even that, like, you have to have some mad pressure going on in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're actually going to talk a little bit about the pressure
in a minute. Andy's bleeding.
Mm-hmm. So, the unfortunate thing with Harrison being locked in this room was that he was able to still hear his crewmates as they were shouting and trying to work their way to freedom. And he started noticing the shouts became less and less, and automatically assumed that they had gotten off of the boat and escaped.
Wow.
In reality, Harrison is the only person to survive. Everybody else drowned.
Wow.
So, and it's only because he got really lucky and got swept up by this water that took him into a room and sealed the door shut behind them, or behind him.
With an air pocket.
Yeah, with an air pocket. Harrison, while he was, you know, a huge helper, he was also not one to just give up. And he decided that he needed to start figuring out what he could do from this air pocket. And if there was another air pocket somewhere, if he could get to there and just kind of, you know, figure out how he was going to manage the situation he found himself in. He went into another room. There was no air pocket in this room, but he was able to find life vests and flashlights. So he then went back to his air bubble, kind of dropped off his supplies, and went into a different room where he found a small amount of food and some Coca-Cola, and he brought those back to his air bubbles. And then there's a couple different sources about how he created a raft. One is saying that he pulled the floorboards down to float on. Some are saying that he found some wood to kind of float on. And then somebody else said that he pulled together the life vests and used those to float. So I'm not entirely sure how he kind of found a resting point on top of the water, but he did. And
he's resourceful.
He's very resourceful. He found that everywhere that he could hold his breath to get to, none of those rooms had air pockets. So he was in the only one. So he ended up with flashlights for a little while, but they didn't last long, and he ended up back in complete darkness again. And he also, one other thing, while he was working from room to room, he wanted to make sure that he wasn't going to get lost. Mm-hmm. So he started tying pieces of fabric and rope that he found together to be able to lead him. And he tied it into the bathroom that he was kind of like creating a base in. And I don't know if he tied it to the sink or the toilet or where he tied it, but he used that then to find his way back as he was exploring what was there.
I love these stories because I feel like there are so many things that you tell me during these stories that I'm like, man, this person was genius.
So smart.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it just comes from not panicking and just, you know, having a level head of like, okay, I am disoriented. I know I'm disoriented. How can I help myself not be disoriented? Granted, he also has a lot of time right now because he's stuck at the bottom of the ocean in a room that has no doors to the outside. And what else is he going to do?
Yeah.
So you have nothing but time to think. And I think that also helps because as you sit there and think, as long as you don't panic and start to spiral, you can typically come up with something.
Yeah. That probably is the key, though. Like, give yourselves, like, 30 seconds to panic and be like, oh, this sucks. And then, like, come back around. I need a solution.
This is the reality. We have to make the best of it.
Yeah.
So clearly we can say that holding your breath and searching for either a way out or supplies is not going to get you very far when you are trapped inside of a boat with every single door to the outside world being locked. Even if he had successfully found a way out of the interior of the ship, there is a couple of really life-threatening hurdles he would have had to overcome in order to successfully swim to the surface. The first, and I'm going to start with the worst for the first. So apparently, when you go down into water and deeper water, there's more pressure. You already mentioned that there's pressure in water that deep.
He could get the bends if he surfaces too quick. Is that it?
That is not the worst one.
That's not the worst one?
That's not the worst one. That is one. That's the next paragraph. But so you suck air in to hold your breath for a long time because you're like, okay, I can get out, but now I have to make the 100-foot swim to the surface. So you get all the air into your lungs that you can possibly get. As you start to move up towards the surface, that pressure lessens. So it starts to allow things to expand, like the air in your lungs. Your lungs can only expand so far, and the air has a greater capacity to expand. So as divers, do they call it ascend in diving?
Sure.
As divers move up towards the surface, they have to exhale periodically to allow for more space for the air in their lungs to expand into.
Or could their lungs pop?
Yeah. Oh. The what I found specifically says that if you don't, it can lead to a severe lung injury and a quick death.
Dang.
So that's the worst one, in my opinion. The second is that he likely would not be able to hold his breath for the duration of swimming to the surface, especially with nitrogen built up in his body and surfacing that quickly. He clearly would have to do it on one breath. And as a result, he would get decompression sickness, which is also known as the bends.
Mm-hmm.
And a very basic level of what the bends is, because I had no idea before I started reading about this stuff, is the nitrogen gas will basically boil out of your blood and tissue, and it releases around your joints, spinal cord, and skull.
Mm-hmm.
And this can cause numbness, paralysis, coordination problems, and
it's extremely painful.
It's extremely painful. And
I've never had it, but I know what the bends is.
Yeah. And they said that the outcome is actually usually pretty good if you're able to get treatment with hyperbaric oxygen mm-hmm. within the first day. After that, they say that some of the symptoms that you get may cause irreversible damage. So clearly this is not a good option either. So I guess on the plus side, he couldn't escape. So it wasn't like he had the option to try to swim to the surface on his own.
Mm-hmm.
So he sat partially submerged in the water. Crayfish began to work their way in and they nibbled on his skin.
Ugh.
And he had swallowed so much salt water that his throat was raw. And so he said that was extremely painful him as well. Initially, Nigerian rescue crews received a mayday call from the Jackson 4, but due to the weather and the hazardous way that the tugboat had landed, paired with the depth that it was at, meant that traditional scuba divers weren't capable of going to the landing site for more than 20 minutes at a time, so they had to wait for a very specialized crew to arrive.
Wow.
About 60 hours after the Jackson 4 sunk, a team of divers arrived to recover the bodies of those who had been on the tugboat. And they were working really carefully because the boat was kind of perched, like, on the cabin top
mm-hmm.
rather than, like, sitting on a side or anything. And so they were worried that something might shift and it might collapse down and trap the diving crew as well.
Dang.
So the divers wore cameras and they had flashlights to be able to see enough to maneuver. And it is this light that caught Harrison's attention. Harrison knew his time was limited. So when he saw the light, he knew he had to react quickly. Reaching his arm through a hole, he grabbed a hold of the diver's arm. And in an attempt not to scare the diver too bad, he then waved at him. So he, like, grabs a hold of the diver and was just like, hi!
Oh, my gosh.
So at first,
if I was that diver, oh, I mean, I would have been ecstatic when I saw that it was, like, an alive human. But yes. Terrified, like, what just grabbed me?
At first, there's a video. And the video that's in the link for one of the sources I used, I put a note. So when you go to this episode and you go scroll down through all of the stuff that I have in the notes, there's sources at the bottom. And I put a note that said, this link has the video. And I didn't watch the video with sound on. I'm sorry. So I can't say for sure or not. But apparently when the diver first saw the hand, he was like, oh, corpse, corpse, corpse. And then he waved, Harrison waved, and the guy was like, he's alive. And
that would be disorienting.
Like, I think it's almost like you don't believe it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe it. I'd for sure be like, okay, the water is moving this body in a really weird way. So,
well, you said 60 hours, right?
60 hours.
Yeah. So at this point, I mean, there's within minutes, most people would have perished.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were fully expecting. They were doing a body recovery.
Yeah.
Not a rescue mission. So later, Eric Hextall, who is a diving medicine specialist, calculated the amount of oxygen available, and he calculated that Harrison had about 56 hours of air. And the interesting thing about his calculation is not that Harrison would run out of oxygen to breathe, but rather the carbon dioxide levels in his body would build up to a level that could not sustain life. Which is interesting, because I think normally you think that the carbon monoxide that is in the area you're breathing in,
yeah,
builds up to a point that you don't get enough oxygen, but it's actually what's happening within yourself.
Oh, that's interesting.
Then Eric provided the information that there is higher levels of carbon dioxide underwater than there is on land. And the 56 hours he calculated is about how much conscious time Harrison had. He also calculated that after this 56 hours, Harrison would begin to experience a sort of high, and then coordination and function would start to decrease before losing consciousness somewhere around the 79-hour mark. So Harrison was probably in that transition window when he was found.
He was already at the point where there was too much carbon monoxide building up.
Yes.
Dang.
Along with this, Harrison was dealing with an increase of air pressure, which causes the human body to not be able to excrete nitrogen that builds up in the body. And this happens to someone that goes deeper than 80 feet of water. So he not only had the nitrogen building up, but also the carbon monoxide building up. And on May 28th, at roughly 7:30 p.m., Harrison was pulled from, I'm going to call it, the wreckage of the boat. He was first put into a diving helmet to provide him vital oxygen, and then they put him into a diving bell. So a diving bell is a bell-shaped device used to raise and lower people from the depths of the ocean, and they have an air pump system to help equalize out the pressure inside of the diving bell. So typically, the way that the diving bell works is that as you're lowered down into the ocean, the air is going to provide the same amount of pressure that's at the surface level.
Nice.
So in the reverse for Harrison, they changed the pressure so that way it was the same as what he was at, 100 feet below.
They could bring him out slowly.
Mm-hmm. And then they brought him out that way. And it is unclear to me exactly how Harrison was put into this device, and if they just like had a door that they opened and then they put him in, water and all, or if they had a way to kind of pump the water out, or what that process specifically looked like.
I imagine. I feel like with technology now,
I'm going to assume. Yeah, I'm going to assume that like if you take something that's hollowed out and completely enclosed and you drop it to the bottom of the ocean, and if there's a door on the bottom, not much water is going to flood in because you've got that air pressure in mm-hmm. there, right?
Or like a double door system, like, you know, like on the space station where, you know, you have the one that you walk through and you have to close it behind so that you keep like the oxygen inside the space station before you actually go out for a spacewalk.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's like a double door system like that.
Maybe. I couldn't find
something that you could like flush the water out in between.
Yeah. Which makes sense.
Yeah.
I couldn't find anything about the actual bell that they used. And the diving bells that I was finding as I was trying to research was basically all about taking people down, and you're not opening the door at the bottom of the ocean for the people to go out and explore. So I couldn't find any conclusive information, but I would assume that they just kind of like worked it in the opposite, that they changed the pressure so that way it matched what he was currently in, and then slowly brought it back to surface pressure. So then he was transferred from the bell to a pressurized chamber, and apparently while they transferred him from the bell to this chamber, he passed out, but he was fine. And once he was in this pressurized chamber, he spent the next 3 days reacclimating there. He was then released from the chamber, and after this, they told him that he should go to the hospital so that way he could have things checked out and make sure everything was good and make sure tests were coming back clean. And he was like, yeah, no, I really just want to go home.
Oh, man.
So he did not go to the hospital. He did not go to a doctor. He was like, I'm going home. Peace. And that's what he did.
That's bold.
Yeah. But also, at the same time, I would also be like, yeah, I think after essentially 6 days of being trapped in some place that I didn't want to be, I think I'm going to go home too.
I don't think I'd do that. I really think I'd go to the hospital.
Okay.
Just to double check that something wasn't weird.
Yeah. I might go to the hospital later, or like...
I mean, hospitals have food and showers and stuff.
Yeah, they do. So but what are the chances that you actually get into it? I mean, I don't know what the hospitals in Nigeria look like.
That's true.
So maybe there's something there, but
maybe
also,
just a cultural difference.
Yeah.
I can see a cultural difference if it's not like our luxury spas that you can walk into in the United States.
Right. Which, and then you pay for the luxury here in the United States too. So once he was home, nightmares would plague him, and multiple times he would jolt awake, pick up his wife, and start carrying her out the door before he realized that he was not actually on a boat and not sinking.
Oh, man.
And I put a little cry face emoji there, because that's really sad. Like, I have nightmares, and some of my nightmares get very vivid. And I almost always wake up, and I'm able to pretty quickly be like, oh, that was a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I've maybe had two where I was like, I need to double check with a friend to make sure that this didn't actually happen.
Oh, that's vivid.
But I have, and I mean, when I was pregnant, I had crazy dreams, and they were all like demonic.
Oh.
I had a dream that I was with my son's father and his group of friends, and we went to a hockey game that was like three levels high, and one of the hockey players got injured, and the entire place started filling up with blood, and so we had to be evacuated. And so as we were walking out the door, one of the attendants walked up to us and handed me a key and said, your adventure awaits. And me being the person I am was like, okay, give me that. And so we were trying to figure out where this key went to. We found this hole in the brick wall that matched the shape of the key, and we opened it, and it released all of these demons that were like, they were like animal mixes, so like cougar top, kangaroo bottom with bat wings. They all had bat wings. And they were all just like flying around, and I climbed up into this tree to try to escape. And, but like, it was just like one of, that's a crazy pregnancy dream. Like,
sure.
Like, I woke up and I for sure was like, what the heck? But I have very realistic dreams, not pregnant. And since that's been the majority of my life,
oh,
that's what I deal with.
See, no, my my dreams, I can always tell are dreams because there's always something that's off about them, right? Mm-hmm. But I have had two really cool dreams in my life that it was almost like me watching a movie.
Okay.
And so one was like a Western and one was more of a, I'm going to say like a suspense mixed, not scary. I would say kind of like a suspense type of plot. And the only way that I can describe it is almost like, if anybody makes this movie, please give me credit. It was like a boat capsized coming over like Plymouth Rock days.
Okay.
And all of the people on the boat, like their ghosts, like came out of the water and ended up like taking over like the bodies of a settlement in this one town. And every 100 years, they're allowed to leave whatever settlement they're in and like move to a different settlement. And so the only thing that you can see is basically these people dressed like pilgrims moving across this field when they're able to like actually release and like find a new settlement. And so they're like walking across this field and they end up taking over this like campground. And the people that are at the campground are normally just there for vacation, but they all end up staying there because they get taken over by these pilgrims. And their family like comes to visit them and they keep asking like, why aren't you leaving? Like, you can't live here. And so then there's this one main character. It's the daughter of like the couple. Her parents basically end up becoming this pilgrim couple, but she doesn't know that, right? And she's the one that finds out, like, she solves the mystery.
That is extremely interesting.
Isn't that fun?
That's a movie that I would watch. And I'm not like a suspense or scary movie type of person, but that's like one that I would be like, I'm intrigued.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to make my movie,
let's do it. Okay. So in an attempt to decompress a little bit, he and his wife went on a trip to Gambia where they ended up staying in a oceanfront hotel, which you would think because it's on the ocean, it would be a little bit triggering for Harrison, but he says that he always felt so much peace with the water that by the time he and his wife returned home, he was feeling okay. However, this unrest did not last long. The rescue divers had found 10 of Harrison's crewmates, one of which was never found. And Nigerians are extremely religious as well as extremely superstitious, and they believe in black magic. And they believe that there was, well, I guess not everyone, but there were some who believed that Harrison had used black magic to summon evil spirits so that way he could survive, and that these spirits in return killed the others on board.
Oh.
This belief caused him not to attend any of his crewmates' funerals because he was worried that the community would lash out against him if he arrived in person.
That's really sad.
Yeah, I agree. So then, 1 year later, after surviving the sinking of the tugboat, Harrison and a friend were driving when they somehow ended up going off of a bridge that they were driving over.
Dear heavens.
Landed again, upside down, and in water. Harrison this time was easily able to escape, but once he was on land, he realized his friend was still in the car, so he went back into the water to retrieve his friend and get them both out of the water. It was his friend who started to question what on earth Harrison was so afraid of, because he had these two incidents happen in a relatively short period of time, and it just didn't seem to make any sense that Harrison would have anything to be scared of. It was that sparked something new for Harrison. Despite he and his wife separating and going through a divorce, he started looking to the ocean again and started looking at diving programs. When he spoke to one of his older brothers about this idea, his brother was like, "No, you shouldn't do this. That sounds dangerous. Don't go back in the water." And Harrison, with his divorce going on, was just feeling so lost and so depressed that he decided to go forward with the 3-month program anyways and then talk to his brother about it after he was done. And in 2015, despite swearing to God that he would never go back in the water, he became a certified commercial diver and now regularly works at depths of up to 165 feet or 50 meters.
Wow.
The rescue diver who found Harrison was the one to give him his diploma.
Aww.
Which I thought was really sweet.
That is sweet.
So Harrison is now close to, and I don't know when his birthday is, so I'm saying close to, 40 years old.
Uh-huh.
He has a new partner. It does not specify that they have gotten married, but they're together and they have 3 children.
Aww.
And so despite all of those traumatic things happening, sounds like life's turned out pretty well.
That's actually pretty incredible that he, you know, went through something that tragic and overcame it and now is diving at depths where, you know, he might actually be saving people.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And I think the part that I really like is that, and I've talked about this in previous episodes too, is that he had this really bad experience and still didn't deny it. Mm-hmm. Like, he just because he had the bad experience doesn't mean that this thing is bad. And clearly he's been okay with it because he's alive and he's got a family and he's working in the water all of the time. Yeah. And I like having that reminder that a bad experience doesn't mean whatever it is that you have experience with is bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an experience that you had, and you get to decide how you let that experience filter into the rest of your life. And it can be good or it can be bad, and that's up to you.
I agree. Because there's the things that happen to you that are bad that you can't explain, like these types of situations. And then there's the things that, you know, somebody might do to you. I feel like when there's a person that's attached to it, that's always harder because yes. You feel that the person had a choice.
Oh, yeah.
But in this type of instance, like, how did he know that a wave was going to hit the tugboat that he was working on and capsize it and he was, you know, going to be stuck in there for 60 hours?
Yeah, you don't.
You don't. Like, those are the types of things that I feel like you can either be traumatized or you can use it to your advantage. And it sounds like he did.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah, well, Anne, thank you for doing this with me. And you can have a baby now. Now that we're done with this one.
Yeah, you'll have to come over. We'll record another one when it's actually here.
Yeah.